appropriate that there be two different sets of different Torah for each of the Seder nights. That would be hopeful to fulfill for, we're in Toronto, still not yet in Yerushalayim, so we still need two sets of different Torah for our Seders. I just came from my son's Seder play across the hall. And during the introduction, the principal, Rabbi Jeffrey Rothman, mentioned my colleague, Rabbi Ezra Starr from Atlanta, who wrote for his son a very beautiful dedication upon his receiving a Siddur, in which he took the voice of the Siddur itself, speaking to his son and dreaming about all the uses that the Siddur would play within his son's life. That it would be there for him during his good times and his hard times. That it would start off being very difficult to read each of the letters, each of the words, but soon enough it would become easier and easier the more that he used it. But if it becomes too easy, then it loses its beauty, it loses its attraction in some way. And perhaps no book is more familiar to us, even perhaps even more than the Siddur, than the Haggadah. It's a book that we have attached so many memories to. As we look into its pages and see its stains, we remember not just the stories that are told around the Seder, but we remember the wine that was spilled too. Everything's in the book. Everything is there. And this quality of the Seder is something which is contained within the Haggadah itself. In describing him almost immediately after, we're told the story of Yitzias Mitzrayim, Avadim Hayinu, the power of Mitzrayim, we're immediately told, B'chol Amar V'lesapir B'Yitzias Mitzrayim, Areza Meshubach. That it is an obligation to expand and to grow our storytelling about the Seder. That it's never enough, and I would argue that it's not just an experience within a given Seder experience in a given year. That it's a mitzvah to be marbet just in that moment around that Seder table, as it was true for Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues. But rather, it's a mitzvah to be marbet from year to year. It's a marbe, mitzvah to be marbe within our appreciation for the Sipur, the mitzvah Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim, to be able to learn more, to constantly be expanding and growing our awareness of the Seder. And so I want to commend each of you for coming out this evening, because I'm sure each of us has been to many of a Seder. And we've heard many Divrei Torah. But we are people who want to be marbe. For people who want to be able to bring something new to our Seder tables, to be able to expand our repertoire of Divrei Torah, and to follow in the footsteps of Rabbi Akiva and his fellows. And I want to specifically call attention to the people who will bring forward these new gems, these new insights, these diamonds for us to bring to our Seders. Because we say, V'afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nevonim, kulanu zakenim. Kulanu yodim es haTorah. Even if we were all sages, all of us wise elders, all would know the Torah. And it is these four descriptors, which is perhaps the first four, the second four of the Seder night, that certainly describes the four people who will be reading and teaching us this evening as well. The four members of the Kollel Yeshiva University Zichron Dov Beit Midrash. And it's truly a privilege for us to be able to partner with them here at Shari Shemayim, for me personally to be able to get to know each of them, and specifically Rabbi Turchiner, who leads the Kollel, to be able to be a Talmud of his, and to be able to constantly be learning from the Torah that he brings to our community. So with that, I'd like to call upon Rabbi Turchiner to introduce each of the speakers.
Rabbi, thank you very much, and thank you again for yet another opportunity for the Beit Midrash to participate here at Shari Shemayim. I think this is our second or third annual Seder Haggadah Night program here at the Shul. I also want to thank Raquel and Jason Goldberg for dedicating the Haggadah Night program this year as last year in memory of their daughter Tmima Aleha Shalom. The program for tonight consists of four Divrei Torah, and these four Torah thoughts that are related to the Seder are meant to be Seder ready, which means, number one, that they're short. The idea is that each one should be 10 minutes or less, half the timer up here to ensure that happens, and the cane as well to ensure that happens. What it means, though, is that we can't do question and answer during each presentation. So all of the presenters will stay at the end, God willing, and be available to discuss, answer questions, and so on at the end of the program. The order of the speakers will be first Yaron Peretz, our Avreich from Israel, who is stationed here at Shaarei Shamayim as a rabbinic assistant. He'll be speaking first. I will be speaking second. Adam Friedman, our rabbinic assistant at Clanton Park, and a native of Thornhill, will be speaking third, and Rabbi Ziering will be batting cleanup, rabbinic assistant at the bayit. The order was not pulled out of a hat. The order is because that's the order of our Divrei Torah in terms of how they connect to the Seder. So that's the order in which they come up. There are source sheets for some of the presentations that should be around. I should note that the source sheets include Shemos. The name of God is found on some of the source sheets. In the event that you want to give them back to us to put them in Geniza at the end of the program, that's fine. Once again, I encourage people to sign in so that they can get the link for the audio recording. And I now introduce Yaron Peretz.
This is the first show sheet, if you have it. Okay. I want to try to understand together how did the Russia, the wicked, become to be wicked. Now, if you see in the source number one, in the Gad of Pesach, the question is, Ma avodah zo lachem? What does this service to you? And our answer to him, Ba'avur ze asa Hashem lei betzeti b'mitzrayim. It is become of what Hashem did for me when I come out of Egypt. And we add, Ilu haya sham, lo haya nigal. For had he been in Egypt, he would not have been freed. The source of this drasha, of this midrash, is from midrash of Rabbi Ishmael. The drasha based on the psukim in Sefer Shmot, chapter 12, you have it in source number 2. V'aya ki yomru elechem binchem, ma avodah zo lachem. Your son will going to ask you, what this service to you? And you're going to tell them. And this is a different answer. ואמרתם זבח פסח ולהשם אשר פסח על בתי בני ישראל. And you're going to tell him that this is the Pesach sacrifice to Hashem, and he forepassed over our houses, and he saved our houses. In the same pasuk, we have another drash of the same sages of Rabbi Ishmael in the Mechilta, in source number 3, והיה כי אמרו אליכם, the question, בשורה רעה נתבשרו ישראל באותה שעה, שסוף התורה תדע להישכח מהם. ויש אומרים, בשורה טובה נתבשרו ישראל באותה שעה, שהם עתידים לראות בנים ובני בנים להם, שנאמר, ויקוד העם וישתחו. And they call it this midrash, בני ישראל receive a good news, a bad news, but in the end, the Torah will be forgotten. And others says, Yesh Omrim, that they received a good news, that in the future they will going to see sons and grandsons. I want to deal with a couple of questions here. First of all, what is the connection between the Midrash and here and the Midrash in the Agadah? Both of them is the Midrashim of Rabbi Ishmael. Second, the Pasuk is the question of the Ben HaRasha, of the weakened son. But a man that forgets is not a Rasha. Then what is the connection between the Rasha and the forgetfulness? Also, if we talk about forgetfulness, according to the Haggadah of Pesach, if he was in Egypt, he would have been left there. It's very hard to a punishment to give to a guy that forgets. And in the end, others said that they're going to see sons and grandsons. But here we talk about the Russia, about the wicked. But probably the sons and grandsons are going to be undecent. What is the good news in it? And we try to understand it according to the great Rebbe from Osiatin, Baal Ole Yaakov, in the book Ole Yaakov. The great Rebbe see that the two parts of the Midrash is a one process in life. And to understand the process, we need to understand the meaning of forgetfulness. We have in source 4, in Sefer Dvarim, והיה אם שכוח תשכח את השם אלוקיך, אלוהיך, והלכת אחרי אלוהים אחרים. If you forget השם אלוהים and follow other gods, that we see that the forget here in Hebrew, שכוח תשכח, it's twice. And Rashi tried to understand the duplication of שכוח תשכח. And in source number 4, in source number 5, we have the Rashi, if you have begun to forget the Torah of your that you learn, eventually you will forget all of it. Now, we need to understand, and here is the drash of the Rebbe from Asiyat. He tried to explain the process that the Rasha starts from forgetfulness. In the beginning, he remembered to do the mitzvot aseh, not to aseh, the positive and negative, but having one problem. He forget the joy, the pleasure, the spiritual pleasure, the liveliness of the mitzvah is forget. We all have sometimes very difficult times that we don't feel the pleasure, the liveliness of the mitzvah in tefillah, in limud Torah, and we feel far from Hashem. And here, says the Rebbe, that this is the difference between the decent and undecent. Both of them stand in the same point, don't feel the joy. But they have different ways to handle it. The decent fulfills the mitzvot and tries again and again until it rises and become joyful again. And feel the joy of the mitzvah and the loveliness of the mitzvah and connect to Hashem until the next time. It's like a circle. But the undecent is fulfilled the mitzvah, but because you don't feel anything, he fulfilled the mitzvah without a kavana, without attention. And because his negligence, he forgets the simcha, the joy, the pleasure in the mitzvot. And as time goes by, he forgets also the mitzvot aseh, and the mitzvot lo taaseh, the negative, and the positive. And after he forgets all the mitzvot. And in the end, he does not keep not anything. And in the end, he starts to believe. And then become a Rasha. And then he asks his father, why does this service to you? And in the Haggadah, we answer him, Ilu haya sham lo haya nigal. If you was there, probably you're going to stay in Egypt. Why? This is not a punishment. This is reality. When you forget that, and you don't feel a part of the community, a part of the nation, you stay behind in Egypt. And this is the first part of the process about the badness. But like every good story, we have a happy end. And here we also have a good news. But we need to understand what is the good news here. Now, the Haggadah, the result of the answer in the Haggadah, from my answer to the wicked guy, is very clear. You are not part of the family, like we said in source number 1. If he was in Egypt, he would stay there. But according to the Midrash of Rabbi Ishmael, that he learned about the good news from the Psukim from the Torah, not from the Haggadah. In the Haggadah, we're talking about present. In the Torah, we're talking about the future. And it will come in the future that the son's going to ask you, what is this service? And also in the Torah, we're talking about sons, in plural. And in the Haggadah, we're talking about son, one, the wicked one. And in the future, according to the Midrash, we can understand that probably this thing, the sons and the grandsons that come to ask in the Torah, Ma avodah zolachem, what is this service? But here they come, really they want to know, because nobody taught them about it. And you answer a different answer, because it's a different question. And we answer that Hashem pasach al beteinu, that Hashem save our houses, our together, including you, including the sons. And the good news, that is not only going to see sons and grandsons, the good news that the sons and the grandsons, the sons of the wicked, come back to the family. And this is the reason that in the end of the Pasuk, Bnei Israel knelt and bowed to be thankful to Hashem about the miracle going to be in the future. And this is the good news that Eliyahu Navi is supposed to bring, according to Sefer Malachi, Veshiv levavot al banim, velev banim al avotam. Chag Sameach.
Thank you very much, Yaron. And for the second divrei, for the second Dvar Torah, the second thought on the Seder, I'll be talking about Arami Oved Avi. If you take a look on the sheets, the ones that say at the top, the origin of Arami Oved Avi, you see a passage from Dvarim, from Parshat Ki Tavo. This is what a farmer is supposed to declare to God at the time when bringing the first fruits, the Bikurim, to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple. And it goes as follows. You shall declare and say before Hashem your God, an Aramean tried to destroy my father, Arami Oved Avi. There are different ways to translate that phrase. I'm taking one of them. An Aramean tried to destroy my father. He descended to Egypt. He dwelled there in small numbers, and there he became a large, mighty, and great nation. The Egyptians harmed us and oppressed us and placed harsh labor upon us, and we cried out to Hashem, God of our ancestors. God heard our voice. He saw our oppression, our struggle, our strain. And Hashem took us out of Egypt with a mighty hand, an outstretched arm, and great awe, and with signs and wonders, and he brought us to this place. He gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. The farmer describes our national historical experience when bringing that first fruit to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, that first fruit is not brought on Pesach. The earliest time you can bring the first fruit is Shavuos. The last time you can bring the first fruit is the day before Hanukkah. So we're entirely out of season at this stage. But if you take a look at the second source on the sheet, you find the Mishnah in the last chapter in Pesachim, which says that at the Seder they pour the second cup, the Kana ben Shoel, and here the child asks. I wrote down child, I wrote down son, because even though it's in the male, nonetheless we understand this to be for both the male and the female. So here the child asks. And then according to the child's mind, according to the child's abilities, the parent teaches. And we are maskil b'gnus, we start with the history of our disgrace, and we conclude with our praise, with our elevation, and we analyze from, says the Mishnah, Arami Oved Avi. We start with an Arami and try to destroy my father, and we continue until we complete the entire portion. And that gives us the guts of the Maggid. That's really the central part of where we tell the story of our departure from Egypt. It takes us from the story of Laban and Yaakov and the descent to Egypt, all the way through the suffering, all the way calling out to Hashem, all the way to, finally, the Makos, the plagues, right up to the math medrash at the sea, about how many plagues occurred at the sea. And what I want to discuss over the next several minutes is, where did this text that we say come from? All these comments on Arami Oved Avi, and why should that matter to us? And I'm building here on the work done by a fellow by the name of Jay Rovner. I gave you the reference in source number 5. The article is available on academia.edu online in a paper called Two Early Witnesses to the Formation of the Mikra Bikurim Midrash. Our text that we say is found in source number 3 on your sheet. This is a translation. I pulled the translation from Sfaria.org because I did not want to sit there retranslating the Haggadah, so I adapted it slightly for our purposes, but basically it's there. It's the translation from that site. And you see, it starts with Sayu Lamad, go out and learn what Laban tried to do, and then it goes verse by verse from what we read in source number 1 with commentary on each verse. So when the text says an Aramean was destroying my father, as they translated on the site, and he went down to Egypt and so on, we talk about how we descended to Egypt, how we were small in number, how we became great and powerful, and we became numerous, and then we quote the verse about what the Egyptians did to us, and we bring Midrashim on what the Egyptians did to us and how they hurt us, and then we talk about how we cried out to Hashem and God heard our voice, and we talk about again in Midrashim what it was that Hashem saw, what it was that Hashem responded to, and then on the flip side of the sheet, Hashem took us out of Egypt, and then again a series of comments about how Hashem was the one who did this, not an angel, not a messenger. Let's ignore Moshe's role. And with an outstretched forearm, with great awe, with signs, wonders, and so on. That's the text that we say in our Haggadah. Daniel Goldschmidt, who's most famous for the Goldschmidt Machzorim, traces this section of the Haggadah to a work called Midrash Tanoim, which was put together by Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman, and which sounds by its name like it should trace to the early centuries of the Common Era, the period of the Tanaim. However, in truth, we don't know exactly when the Midrash Tanaim comes from, and as we're going to see, it's not from the period of the Tanaim. It's actually from later. But these Midrashim are so fundamental that take a look at source number 4. I had to bring this for you on the sheet. Rabbi Natronoi Gaon, one of the leaders of 9th century Babylonian Jewry, and by extension world Jewry, because people wrote their questions to him from all over. He was shown a Haggadah, which was an Israeli Haggadah, in which most of what we saw in number 3 is not found. Take a look at what he said. Regarding one who recites Kiddush of Pesach, who redeemed Israel, the passage from the Kiddush itself, and when he completes Manishtana, doesn't say, Abadim Hayinu, we were slaves of Paro in Egypt, and doesn't say, at first our ancestors were idolaters, Mitchila of the Avodah Zarah, but instead says the passage from Yoshua, from Joshua, that's found in our Haggadah, Yoshua told the entire nation, through, and Yaakov and his children descended to Egypt, and says, Baruch Homer, Shomer Abtachaso, blessed is the one who guards, up to Seyu Lamad, go out and learn. So a person, in other words, who chops out most of the rabbinic commentary found in the Maggid, and then says, from an Aramean tried to destroy my father, until he completes the entire passage, the verses as they are, without any midrash, if you just say the verses without the commentary, and then he says, Rabbi Gamliel, Asher Ke'alanu, and Halil. In other words, the Haggadah that they've shown Rav Natronoi Gaon is a stripped-down Haggadah. Without a lot of the rabbinic commentary, he says, this is greatly shocking. If people could please turn off their phones, that might be useful. He says, this is greatly shocking. Not only does one who practices this fail to fulfill his obligation, but anyone who does this is a heretic of split heart, denying the words of the sages, degrading the Mishnah and Talmud, and all communities must excommunicate him and separate him from the Jewish community. And he quotes a verse from Ezra, he shall be separated from the community of the exile. Is the sages' comment of we were slaves, Abadim Ayinu, not Torah? And he goes on. He views it as Karaitic for us to exclude the rabbinic commentary that's there in the Maggid. He considers it central to the mitzvah. Now, looking at this text here that we have, which Rabbi Natronoi Gaon clearly believes is critical and crucial, I might have expected the answer for the question of its origins to be, it's a single united midrash that was plunked into the Haggadah. After all, other parts of the Haggadah are like that. The math medrash at the sea of how many plagues took place is a unit. Dayenu is a unit put into the Haggadah. We don't have multiple versions floating around. The Abadim Ayinu is a paragraph that's there in the Haggadah. The story of the four kids has different versions between the Yerushalmi and other places, but it's put into the Haggadah as a unit. However, when you look carefully at Arami Oved Avi, you find that it's not a unit. It's not. Some of the lines seem to be working across purposes or with very different messages. If you take a look at the beginning of source number 3, the parts that I have in italics and bold. And he went down to Egypt, describes Yaakov going down to Egypt. And it says he was helpless. Because the statement had already been made by God that we would have to go down to Egypt, he goes down, he's going to stay there. But then the very next line says that he resided there not intending to stay, but only to be there temporarily. There's a contradiction right here. The Aruch HaShulchan has one justification, the Malbim has another justification, but the justifications are calling to our attention the fact that you have contradiction right here in the opening lines of this Medrash. Not only that, some of this Medrash describes our experience in Egypt, and some of it is theological, right? The passage that talks about how Hashem did this all himself on the flip side. Not through an angel, not through a seraph, not through a messenger, and all of that is theological. It doesn't talk about our experience in Egypt at all. It's some lesson about how God acts. Not only that, if you go back to the first side, I'm rushing a little bit with this. You see the phrases that I underlined. In the beginning, it starts out by learning lessons from verses with the phrase, this teaches, milamed. But then after that, it shifts format. to Kimashane Amar, as it is stated. If you have chants at your Seder, like we have at, you know, my family's Seder, Kimashane Amar, or whatever your tune is, you're familiar with it. Every time you get those words, Kimashane Amar, Kimashane Amar, it just over and over and over again, that's a unique phrase. That phrase does not normally show up, certainly not in series, in Medrash, anywhere else. It's unique to the Haggadah. And it demonstrates that that part of the text develops as a block, the part that builds on the verses using this Kamashin Emma refrain. Some of these passages in Arameo Vedavi are found elsewhere as separate small pieces of Midrashim in random places. We talk about the outstretched arm being the sword extended over Jerusalem. That's a verse from Divrei Hayamim for Chronicles that's actually speaking about punishment of Jerusalem. And we take it entirely out of context and use it here. There are similar passages throughout this. If you look at the Rovner paper that I referenced in number 5, you can see much more about this. But to make a long story short, Rovner shows via manuscripts from the Cairo Geniza from the 9th, 10th, 11th century that actually what we have as this Midrash on Arameo Veda Avi was grafted together over a period of time. Different communities added different drashot, added different lessons from these verses. And again, it's a 10-minute Dvar Torah. There isn't time to go through all the fragments of the manuscripts. I would have put them out here on the paper for you. But you can look at the paper and see it for yourself. This Arameo Veda V is not like the other parts of the Haggadah. It's not like Rabban Gamliel. It's not like Dayenu. It's not like the Math Medrash, which come in intact. Here we are being, to use the words of the Mishnah, Doresh. The psukim. We are learning these passages and teaching these passages to our families. And when it shows up in Midrash Tanaim of Rabbi David Tzvi Hoffman, it's not because it was originally in the Midrash and then in the Haggadah. It was formed in the Haggadah and then taken from there and put in this work, Midrash Tanaim. Now, what that means is that over time, Jewish families and Jewish communities sat down in advance of Pesach and said, what am I going to learn? What am I going to say about these verses? What can I learn related to this passage of the Bikurim, this passage about the Aramean who tried to destroy my father? And they drew in descriptions of our suffering, and they drew in this piece about Hashem taking us out of our exile personally, which is found in a Mechilta, in Rabbi Yehuda's acronym for the plagues, which teaches us lessons about the plagues. That's what we are meant to do. According to the abilities of those at the table, like the Mishnah said, we learn the Haggadah. And as Rav Natronoi Gaon said, that's fundamental to Seder experience. That's what we're supposed to be doing. So what does that mean for us? It means that we are also supposed to sit down in advance of the Seder and ask ourselves, what other areas of Torah am I familiar with that might augment my Seder experience? I gave you one example in source number 6. We could read about other Sedarim found in Tanakh. The Seder that they made in the times of Yechezkel, the Seder they made in the times of King Yoshiyahu, the Seder they made when they returned to build the second temple. I had them ready to hand because we have an Ezra Shir right down the hall on Tuesday afternoon, so I had that ready to hand. But that's an example of something one could do in order to get a better appreciation of what the Seder has meant for us throughout Jewish history. Or we could learn them in Haggim, the customs of Jews who have had different practices. This is a benefit of the internet. You can find customs that no one ever heard of. You can find customs people just made up. You can find all sorts of things, but you can, seriously, to learn the legitimate practices of different Jewish communities and how they acted out the Maggid. We can learn the Gemara found at the end of the volume of Psachim about the Seder and its mitzvos. Now, our Sedarim are long. And they start late, thanks to the joys of daylight savings time. However, we can always add these explorations in advance of Pesach. Nothing says that it has to happen at there is a mitzvah of discussing at the Seder. But getting ourselves in the mood is something we can already do in advance. Shabbos HaGadol, Daylight Savings Time, gives us a long afternoon. You can sit down and learn these things, and then they can be part of the discussion at the meal during the Seder. But these can help to augment our experience. To create a pre-Pesach Haggadah effectively for our families will enhance our experience on Seder night. There was a time in Jewish history when Arami Oved Avi was new, and it has now become a cornerstone of our Pesach experience. Who knows what we might create and pass along to future generations. Thank you. Adam, please.
Good evening. I want to speak tonight a little bit about Charoset. So I have the sheet which has Charoset as the title. So Charoset, which maybe for lack of a better phrase, is like a relish. You know, a lot of us make it with apples, with nuts, with different spices. It sits on the Seder table. What exactly is it about? And we find, if we start to look at the Talmudic account of this, there's a lot of debate about what it is. It seems like it was on the Seder table for many generations, but it's so vague that there's even a debate about whether this is part of the ritual sections of the Seder, or maybe it's just on the table for some sort of pragmatic reason. So we look in source one, we see that in the Mishnah, the Tannaitic scholars had a debate about whether or not this is even something which you have to do at the Seder, or it's there for some other reason. They set before them the unleavened bread, lettuce, charoset, although charoset is not compulsory, it's not a mitzvah. Rabbi Elazar Bar Tzaddok says that it is compulsory. It is a mitzvah. There's a debate at a basic level. Is there a mitzvah to do charoset or not? We hold that there is a mitzvah. We assume that there's a mitzvah to do charoset. And that raises a question. Because all the other things that we do at the Seder, which include a mitzvah, eating matzah, eating maror, include with them also a bracha. We make a bracha about eating matzah, we make a bracha of alachilat maror. Why don't we make a bracha over the charoset? If charoset is a mitzvah after all, why not make a bracha? That's question number one. As we see the debate unfold in the Gemara, there's a discussion about different possible symbolisms. We don't look at it inside totally, but it's here in source number two. There's a question about what to do or what the reasoning would be, assuming that charoset is not a mitzvah. And assuming that it is, we find a debate. One side says that this is zecher letit. It's in memory of the mortar that the Jews used, that they worked with to build in Egypt. The other side says that it's Zecher l'tapuach, in memory of the apple. The apple is a reference to a pasuk from Shir Hashirim, tachat ha-tapuach v'harticha, under the apple tree I awakened you, and it refers to a poetic image about the relationship between God and Bnei Yisrael, and specifically in the context of coming out of Egypt. So we have these two symbols. Either it's in memory of the mortar, Zecher l'tit, about our slavery, or we're remembering the Tapuach, the exodus from Egypt. And that leads maybe to a second question. We already have these symbols at the Seder table. We already have Maror. Maror is about bitterness. It's about the bitterness of our slavery. We already have other symbols about our freedom, the Korban Pesach, which we don't have today, unfortunately. Matzah, to a certain extent. Why do we need a redundant symbol which talks about either slavery or about freedom? So those are our two questions. Why don't we make a bracha on Charoset? And also, in terms of the symbolism, why exactly do we need these redundant symbols? So in terms of answering the first question, one approach which is taken by many is that the charoset, we don't make a bracha on it because it's something secondary. We dip other foods into the charoset. We generally dip maror. According to the Rambam, you would dip other things. You dip the karpas, you dip matzah. But it's something that other foods are dipped into, and you shake it off. You don't want it to taste too strongly like charoset. And because it's secondary, because it's not something primary, you don't make a bracha on it. It's subsumed under the brachas that we make over the other foods that we eat at the Seder. A second possible explanation is offered by Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik in terms of a close reading, a careful reading of source number 3 of the words of the Rambam. And here he describes the Haroset. It's a rabbinic mitzvah in memory of the mortar which they worked with in Egypt. How do we make it? We take dates or figs or raisins or something similar and mash them, add vinegar, most people add vinegar, and spice it with spices similar to the way straw is added to mortar, and we place it on the table on the nights of Pesach. So Rabbi Soloveitchik says, it doesn't say that we have to eat the charoset. What the Rambam says is that you have to place it on the table. We do eat it. We eat it also. But perhaps the primary goal, the primary requirement of the charoset, is just to have it sitting on the table. That's really the goal. And if the mitzvah is only for it to be sitting on the table, that's not something which is defined with any sort of definitive act. They don't put it on the, it has to be on the table throughout the Seder. So perhaps if that's the core of the mitzvah, we wouldn't make a bracha on that either. What we find from both of these answers is that charoset is something passive. It's not something which is something that jumps out of you as a fundamental staple of the Seder, but it's something which is there and adding to the atmosphere. It's on the table. It's a symbol which sits there and reminds you of itself. It's something that we put onto food, not to taste it too strongly, but to taste it a little bit, something in the background. So how can we take this notion, in terms of the answer of our first question about the bracha, and apply it further to the symbolism? Why is it that we have redundant symbols of freedom and of slavery at the Seder? So if we consider the notion of teeth, that zecher letit, the mortar, we think carefully, we see that in the Torah, there is actually an episode in Parshat Shemot which describes the story of the teeth, which involves the mortar. And that is, at the end of Parshat Shemot, Aaron and Moshe come to Pharaoh and try and convince him to let the Jews go. And we have this here in source number 4. And Pharaoh says, why are you trying to distract the people from their work? Why are you trying to get them to stop working? You should get out of here. Go to your labor. That day, Paro commands the taskmasters and the people that are in charge of the Jewish slaves to take away their quota of straw. They used to receive straw to make the mortar that they used to build bricks. They won't get them anymore. The quota will still be the same, but you won't get straw. You're going to have to work even harder. And I think the key line, Psukim here 8 and 9 that we have, the quota of bricks which they've been making heretofore until now, you'll place upon them, because they're idle, and therefore they cry, saying, let us go and sacrifice to our God. The work will become heavier for the people, and they'll do it, and then they won't speak of empty things. They won't rely on empty things. I think what's being pointed out here is a very specific nuance to the slavery that existed in Egypt. We talk about the maror as a avodat parich. It's backbreaking, difficult work. The work itself is difficult and it's hard to do. It's draining. But there was also a psychological component. There was also the quota of bricks. The mortar represented a psychological pressure on the Jews. We have to get this amount of work done. It's an impossible task. It's a huge amount of work. It takes up all of our headspace, all of the psychological space that we might have had to think about other things, to consider other ideas, is taken up by this work, by the notion, by the responsibility of producing this quota of bricks. And perhaps that's what we mean when we say zecher letit. The charoset either sits on the table, it's something we dip the foods into, it's a quiet, passive reminder, but it recolors the entire vision of the Seder. The same way it recolored the entire vision, the entire perspective that the Jews had in Egypt. I have everything that I'm doing, I have my family, my livelihood, my life, but in the background there is the psychological pressure of the mortar, the bricks that have to be made, which don't allow me to think about God, which don't allow me to think about anything else. That's one possibility. What if we say that charoset is zecher letapuah, that it's trying to recall the apple, the relationship between God and the Jews? Then perhaps we can look at other descriptions in Shir HaShirim, other descriptions in the Song of Songs where this pasuk about the apple emerges from. And as we look through Shir HaShirim, one of the themes which emerges is the notion of hide and seek. the Jews are, you know, it's a description of two lovers. One of them, you know, we understand refers to God, the other to Bnei Yisrael, Jew, and there's a hide and seek dynamic. Each one is seeking the other one. They don't necessarily ever meet. They almost meet. They sort of meet. They're trying to find each other. I have just one example here. The voice of my beloved, this is in source number 5. Behold, it comes leaping over mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle, like a young stag. There he stands behind our wall, gazing through the window, peering through the lattice. You have the vision of the beloved standing somewhere, and her lover is somewhere hiding, looking. She can't see him, but he's there somewhere peering out. And if you want to see further, a very beautiful description, elaboration of this idea, in the first chapter of the book, From There You Shall Seek, Ubikashta Misham, by Rabbi Soloveitchik, he has a very beautiful sort of poetic reconstruction of this dynamic. So if we're going to say that this is true, and this notion of hide and seek sort of defines the relationship between the Jews and Bnei Yisrael, then even though we didn't see it at the time, perhaps in retrospect, we see certain descriptions of the relationship between God and the Jews, even as they were in Mitzrayim, even as they were subdued and slaves, there was still a relationship with God. God was still watching out for them. And we see a reflection of this in the last source, in source number 6. This is a description just before God sends Moshe to go and free the Jews. It happened over the course of those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel groaned from their work and cried out. It doesn't say they cried out to God. It just says they cried out in general. And the cries caused by their work arose to God, and God heard their cries, and God remembered his covenant with Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and God saw the children of Israel, and God knew. Even though Bnei Yisrael were suffering, and in their suffering they weren't necessarily even thinking about God, they were crying out, God saw them, and he understood, and he took action to save them. So perhaps the notion of Zechu Tapuach is about something else, which in retrospect, in reconsidering the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim, we also come to understand colored the whole scene, which is the relationship that we had with God, the presence of God with us, suffering in slavery, and eventually taking us out of that slavery. So we've seen the notion of charoset, the idea that this is a passive kind of symbol which colors the whole evening, which may have something to do with the psychological pressures of slavery, and also with the relationship that we discovered we had with God the whole time as part of the Yitziat Mitzrayim experience.
Okay, so clean up. So as we get to the end of our Seder, and I don't know how late this is for you, but after we finish the story and we finished eating the meal and we've opened the door for Eliyahu, we get to the end, we have Hallel. And now, maybe we still have energy to sing, maybe at that point we don't have the energy to sing and we say the words. But the Seder does end with Hallel, and that's where we have the last of the four cups. That is an integral part of the Seder. And classically, and I think there's much truth to this, but I want to push it farther, we think that why do we have Hallel to Seder? Because in addition to telling the story of the Seder, we need to experience it. And part of experiencing it is feeling the joy, is feeling the exhilaration, and is thanking God. And as if we were there, we burst out in song. We even divide our song. We have part of it during Maggid, part of it as we're telling the story. We say the paragraph which most directly relates to that moment when we left Egypt, B'tzei Yisrael Mitzrayim, when the Jews left Egypt. And then we continue it later at the end of the Seder, because again, we're trying to make our Seder not just be about the story, but also to be about the experience. Chayav Adam Lirot or Laharot et Atzmoki Lu Yatsami Mitzrayim. We have to see ourselves as if we left Egypt, and therefore we have to feel thankful that here we are, we ourselves have been slaves for 210 years, and now we're going free. But I want to suggest that maybe to keep ourselves awake, we should think about Hallel in a second way. Hallel is clearly song. But as Rabbi Terjiner said, our goal each year should be to spend time thinking about the story in a different way. I want to suggest not just to think about Hallel as song, but think about Hallel as story. Because you think about it, the Hallel that we have is called by Chazal, is called by the rabbis, Hallel HaMitzri.
It's called the Hallel that discusses leaving Egypt, Hallel HaMitzri. And when you actually look at the chapters that we read, you realize that it's not just praise. It actually adds to our understanding of the narrative itself. But we don't notice it because either we say it or even if we sing it, we're so caught up in the joy, we don't notice the subtleties of the story that it's telling us about the Exodus from Egypt. Now, we were supposed to go in order here, but I'm half cheating because I put one of the chapters from Maggid and one from the end. But you'll forgive me. But for example, if you look at number one, Mitzvah Yisrael Mitzrayim, when the Jews left Egypt. So if I asked you, what counts as the Exodus? What counts as Mitzvah Yisrael Mitzrayim? When would you start it? And when would you start that moment? Start it, I don't know, when Moshe first sees the Egyptian and kills him and begins the story, when God sends Moses, I don't know. When would it end? So if you'd asked me, I would have ended the story at the splitting of the sea, maybe. Maybe Kabbalah HaTorah, maybe the acceptance of the Torah 7 weeks later. That's what I would have told you, is B'tzeit Yisrael Mitzrayim, but look what we actually say. B'tzeit Yisrael Mitzrayim, Beit Yaakov Mamloes. When Israel went forth from Egypt, the house of Jacob, from a people of strange speech. So Judah became his Holy One, Israel his dominion. Hayam Ra'av Hayanos, the sea saw and fled. But then we say, Hayarden Yisov La'achor, the Jordan fled. When did the Jordan flee? 40 years later, when they went into Israel. And Amos Chacham, in the Dan Mikra commentary to Tehillim, points out that the author of this chapter thinks that Yitzhiyat Mitzrayim didn't end at the beginning of the 40 years. The whole 40 years is B'tzeit Yisrael Mitzrayim. And suddenly you realize that if we're telling B'tzeit Yisrael Mitzrayim, and we include the splitting of the Jordan, and not just the splitting of the sea in Egypt, that the story we're supposed to tell is at least a story of 40 years. And you continue, Ha'arim Rakdu Keilim, Gevaot, Givnei Tzon. But look at the end, look at Pasuk Chet, the last verse. We summarize, Ha'ofri Hatsur Agamayim Chalamish L'mayno Mayim. God who turned the rock into a pool of water, the flinty rock into a mountain. But those two words, there are two words in that verse for rock, Tzur and Selah. Those aren't accidental. There are two stories in Chumash where Moshe hits a rock. At the beginning of the 40 years, when God actually told him to hit the rock, and then at the end of the 40 years, when God told him to speak to the rock. But both times he gets water out of the rock by hitting it. In the first time, and I gave you the verse, I'm not going to read it inside, in the first time it's called a tzur. And in the second one, it's called a selah. Which means that he's hinting. The author of this perek of Tehillim, whoever it is, Moshe Rabbeinu or someone later, commemorating the Midrash, argues exactly who wrote it. It's telling you that we're telling the story of God who gave us water in the desert, but not just at the beginning, at the end. Which means, but Satan Yisrael Mitzrayim tells us the story you're telling on Seder night is not just the story of those first few days, those first few weeks. It's the story of 40 years. And therefore, if we look at Hallel as story, not just as song, that means we should be thinking, what is the story of our 40 years? And what is it? So if you look, for example, in the middle of 2, at the end, after the Jews complained about not having water, in the last verse, the verse tells us, what was the challenge? They called that place Masal Miriva, a place of fighting, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested God, saying, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu amayin, is God among us or not? When the Jews asked for water, it wasn't just that they needed water. They thought that God had abandoned them. They thought that God was with them in Egypt, but then left them in the desert to die. And therefore, when they didn't have water, they suddenly panicked and said, where is God, who just a few weeks ago told us that He loved us, took us as His own, but now He's abandoned us and we have no water. So when they didn't have water, they said, Hayesh Hashem b'kirbeinu amayin, is God here? And God gives them water. And it's a resounding yes. And as Adam mentioned before, part of the Seder is telling the story of how we forged a relationship with God. How we didn't really see Him, but we slowly came to realize that God was among us. And that wasn't a process that ended at the beginning of our journey. It went the whole 40 years. Because it's true, at the beginning, the first time they lack water, they panic. Then maybe God has given up on them, and 40 years later, they're doing the same thing. When it's Sur and when it's Selah. And the same thing is true if you continue into actual Hallel. Look at number 4, Lolanu. Perkuf Tetvav, Lolanu Hashem, Lolanu. We say, not to us, Lord. Not to us, but to your name bring glory for the sake of your love and your faithfulness. And then in Pasuk Bet, we say, Lamu Yomru Hagoyim Ayena Eloyim. Why should the nations say, where is your God? Now that line also is borrowing from a critical moment in the desert. If you look in 5, I won't read it inside, but this is what Moses says to God when he has nothing to argue after. The golden calf, he turns to God, and God says, your nation has corrupted themselves. I took them out of Egypt to be my nation, and look what they've done. And God says, and Moses turns to God and says, you're right. What am I going to say? They did sin. There's only one thing I can say when there's nothing to say, which is, you're right, they don't deserve to live, but Lama Yomru Mitzrayim Lemor, Bara Hotziyam, La Rogotam Be'arim. If you kill them, Egypt is just going to say that you couldn't bring them in to the land of Israel. So we quote that. We quote that story, and we remind God that even after we sinned, right, we weren't just at this pinnacle when we left Egypt, but later on we would sin. We wouldn't deserve to be His nation, and Moses would turn to God and say, too bad. Because part of the Egypt story was that we are now your nation, like it or not. And therefore, even if you don't want to save us, you have no choice for your name, for your honor, for your dignity. And He manages to save the Jews against all odds by teaching God, so to speak, that when we left Egypt, not only did He accept us as His nation, but He can't let go of us. I think if you look through Hallel, you'll find time and time again that Hallel is more than just a song on Seder night. It's a story. It helps us take the full perspective, the full picture of what it means to have left Egypt. It reminds us that it didn't end in the days or even weeks or months when we left Egypt. It continued. There were 40 years where we struggled. Is God going to give us water? Is God really among us? Does He love us? Does He not? And we slowly learn to feel that relationship with God. We slowly learn to trust Him. And that's part of the story. That's part of the story we think about on Seder night. How we forged that relationship over 40 years. It's not just the story of the splitting of the sea, but it's the story of the splitting of the Jordan. Because part of leaving Egypt wasn't just leaving Egypt, but was having a place to go to. Was building a land. Was building a nation. Was forging a national destiny. It's not just the story that God chose us and saved us. It's the fact that God can't give up on us anymore. Because even if He wants to, Lama Yomru Hagoyim, what is He going to say if He destroys us? And by saying Hallel, not just singing it, by telling the story of Hallel, we remember that the story of the Exodus from Egypt continued for 40 years and has continued for thousands of years. Because it didn't end in those days or weeks. But every time we don't deserve to continue to be in God's nation, we can turn to God and say, but remember what happened as we were leaving Egypt? Moses convinced you that you can never give up on us. So what are you going to do? You're stuck. But that's part of our story. And it is when we left Egypt, and it is till today. And I leave you not with not just a few ideas, but with a challenge. That this year when you read Hallel, pay attention to the story it's telling and not just the song it's singing. Realize that it's telling not just the story of those first few days, those first few weeks. It's telling the story of Jewish history. It's telling the story of the Exodus as it's continued from generation to generation. And as we realize the story that's being told is one that continues to unfold, as Richter Chiner said, we'll be able to add our own commentary and really understand the story that we're writing for ourselves, which, it may be thousands of years later, but really is just the continuation and perhaps the culmination of the Exodus from Egypt. So Chag Kasher v'Sameach, and thank you again for coming.